That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
ThatGreatBusinessShow.com is brought to you by De Facto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 88 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 13th of May, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran, and I think we have our busiest ever episode of your favourite business podcast today, with a guest list longer than a Dublin airport queue. Regular listener Jeff Bezos, the world's second richest man, is in for a bit of a shocker when we tell him that Amazon is not the world's first online bookshop. That title is held by an Irish company, and we'll have more on that. I could tell you that we'll also have an item about embedded finance orchestration, but we want to keep you listening, so instead we'll tell you how you might be able to transfer money internationally up to 8 times cheaper than the so-called pillar banks. And the guys behind Reward Catering, that's Europe's largest food truck and catering trailer manufacturer, well, we had one of them on before, are all here to tell us why they've started a new business to cut the price of medicine, as you do. And don't forget to listen back to Colette Toomey, the human dynamo behind Clonakilty Black Pudding and her plans for her brand new 18-hole golf club. She joined us last week on episode 87. This is The Great Business Show, after all, where we do business differently. And this and all our great business insights and tips today and on other days are brought to you, as always, thanks to our sponsor, De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best all-natural shaving oil.
De Facto Shaving Oil, smooth as.
Eat your heart out, Jeff Bezos. You may be worth more than the entire island of Ireland, but your Amazon isn't the world's oldest online bookshop. Incredibly and impressively, that title goes to one of our own, Kenny's Bookshop in Galway, now 82 years old, which obviously predates the birth of the internet before someone points that out. They've been online, though, since 1994, and from that they have developed a world business, particularly selling special collections and archives aimed at institutions in Ireland and overseas, mainly in the US. We have asked Sarah and Tomás Kenny, both of the Kenny family, to join us to share with us what they've learned from almost 30 years of online selling. Sarah and Tomás, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Good to
and
be
I've
here.
I've got to ask what everybody else is asking. Who got the gold coins? Where did the gold coins come from? And for those who do not know what I'm talking about, there were two gold coins found in a book in Kenny's bookshop last week or 2 weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, last week, that's right. We bought a collection from a private collector who wishes to remain anonymous, and 25,000 books. And in the midst of them was this prayer book, which is in itself totally unremarkable, not particularly worth anything. But hidden in the back, attached to the spine, were two gold 1947 Mexican coins. So they were pure gold, 37.5 grams each, and weighed a decent amount. And
that's over an ounce each.
Yeah, exactly.
20 grams to an ounce.
Yeah, so it was a remark. I mean, we found a lot of things in books over the years, but it's the first time we found actual treasure.
How do you find in the spine? I mean, was it...
When I say the spine, it was... There's a lot of the clerical books would have soft leather covers, and to protect them, they have this kind of bespoke leather cover outside the original cover, and it's generally attached to the cover. So for whatever reason, and our archivist, Sarah Gallagher, fair play to her, she decided to have a look behind the cover and attached to the spine. Yeah, there were the two coins.
So are the Kenny profits about to be bumped up by 5,000 euro?
Well, they were, what we decided to do was, well, initially we contacted the people who we bought the library from to tell them that we had found them, and just to say, you know, we obviously were not buying a library from you expecting to buy gold and if they belong to someone and all the rest. So they came back and said, look, it's part of what we sold you, so do with it what you will. So we decided that we would try and sell them and donate the money to charity. And it didn't take too long because there was multiple inquiries fairly quickly. There was a huge reaction to it. So we've sold the two coins and we're going to split the money between two charities. There's the Galway Simon Community and the Irish Red Cross Ukraine Appeal.
Couldn't do better, I don't think. Well done, you two. Or well done, Kenny's Bookshop, which is a nice note on which to start. You're bigger or older than Jeff Bezos. Discuss.
Yeah, not bigger yet. That's 2023's plan. In the early 90s, the digital plant in Galway, which was a huge employer in the west of Ireland, closed. And
that, to those who don't know, is DEC, Digital Electronic, whatever it was. DEC, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It was a company called Digital rather than a digital plant. If you're
yes, exactly. And it closed. And it meant there was a lot of, I suppose, very well-educated, high-tech individuals out of jobs as soon as, you know, electronics were taking off in a way, I suppose, your personal electronics. So a guy came into us, he was looking to start up Ireland Online and he wanted a company basically that he could build a website around it that was a well-known company. And he asked if we'd be interested and he'd build our site and then he would sell us as a, you know, to other businesses
a
around
case
Ireland.
Study.
Exactly. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that because I didn't ask.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So we said yes. And, or at least I should say our father and uncles and aunts said yes. And but lo and behold, we had a website without really knowing what a website was.
I don't think anybody did, in
early 1994. And I mean, it was problematic at the start because, you know, there was no such thing as a shopping cart as we were kind of, you know, it was email only, and even email then people, you know, were just mistrustful of it, and you'd get queries from America and you think this is amazing and they want 20 bucks and you'd spend 2 hours finding the 20 bucks because of course you didn't have a stock control system the way you would now, and you'd find the 20 bucks and then you'd email them and list them all off, which would take forever because you weren't used to using the keyboard, and then the next day you'd be expecting to get a credit card information and address, and of course they go, oh, thanks but no, I actually decided or I might take one of them. How much is shipping? And then you'd have to go and figure out how much shipping would be to wherever it was they were and all of the rest of it. So it took a lot of getting used to, but we figured it out in the end.
And that, in whatever you've just talked for about 2 minutes, is the history of the internet, isn't it? It's mad.
Well, it's kind of strange, even that shopping cart element. It was 2004. So it was 1994 that the website was launched, kennys.ie. And it was 2004 before a customer could go on and make a transaction themselves to place an order, which is kind of hard to believe now, you know. Whatever it is, 18 years later, that, you know, they initially, it was 10 years a website without people being able to make a transaction on it. So.
And I was mocking Jeff Bezos, but in fact, what he did very cleverly was he was the originator of the one-click purchase. And he had, that was his IP. And that's where he made his early billion, zillion, grillions, whatever he has nowadays. So we've now moved to 2004. So I now have the shopping cart. How has this changed the Kenny business in 2004?
In 2004, our bookshop was based in High Street in Galway, which was right in the city centre. It was a beautiful shop. It was across two streets and three floors high, and it was a bookshop and art gallery. And, you know, gradually as we went online and as people could order from us online, the business started to get bigger. And so in 2006, it was decided that we would move out to a warehouse on the outskirts of Galway in Lisbon Retail Park, which is where we're based now, to focus on our bookselling online. And
your pals in the media thought this was the end of the world.
Yeah, it was funny at the time. The, you know, when we came together, the message really was, you know, we're moving, we're not closing. But for many years, people thought Kenny's had closed completely just to focus online. But actually what happened was the business moved location. And so we're in Lisbon Retail Park. It's still a walk-in bookshop. The art gallery is there. We run the entire business from there. So it's just that we moved location as opposed to closed. And now I think if we were now where we were then in terms of in the high street, because people still talk about that old shop and how they miss it. You know, we couldn't do what we do from where we are now if we were in the high street. Logistically, we have space. It's a huge building. We've hundreds of thousands of books on site. We've a huge amount of car parking, and on post come, we ship everything with on post, and they come every evening at 4:30 in a huge truck to collect 4 or 5 cages of parcels to ship around the world. And we just could not do that from from High Street. So it's worked itself out, you know, in many ways.
Now, when you were selling from High Street, from the High Street in Galway, people got to know you because they could see you, etc. When you move to a business park, people cannot see you. What is the secret of getting yourselves known? I know I won't say that you're a niche player, but you have certainly made your name within a niche. I'm sure you sell all things to all persons. And so what's the secret for our listeners about when you are trying to sell online, just to get yourself in front of people so that, you know, they see that there's size. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of books.
Yeah, like we have the most amount of books in one building outside of a library in the country, you know. And
that's a fantastic claim.
Yeah, I mean, it's mad.
It also means there's an awful lot of capital tied up.
Oh, 100% that our accountant would agree with you. Our father used to say that his father told him, if our bank account was as good as our PR, we'd be doing very well. And that was because we were always, I suppose, relatively media savvy. And certainly in terms of getting our name out, that's good. But I suppose the big difference with online selling in particular is that it removes the need for that, because it's a very democratic thing, the internet. So nobody in America is going to care whether we're a family business, in, you know, et cetera, that we're Irish, that we're this, that we're that. They care, can we get the book to them? Do we have the book, first of all? Is it catalogued correctly? That is to say, does it have an image? Does it have, you know, the right details? Can we get it to them quickly? And can we get it to them quickly for a good price? And if we can do that, eventually people will find you. It might not happen immediately and whatever, but that's what we did. We concentrated on providing the service and having the material and having. So in order to do that, you need a lot of things. You need to be able to ship in bulk, because that's the only way you can do it in you know, get a decent price from suppliers.
What do you call bulk?
So we ship, if you add everything up, we ship approximately 300,000 to 400,000 books a year.
Okay, that's bulk.
Yeah.
Divide by 52. Okay. Yeah. A lot of books.
Yeah, and absolutely. It is a substantial amount. And it means we have to kind of constantly be buying and selling. So you need to know what you're buying. You need to be able to buy it at a good price. You need to be able to catalogue it correctly. You need staff that can pick quickly, that can ship quickly, that know what they're doing. All of that. But also, you know, don't have to be worried about, you know, the amount of miles they're walking around an Amazon warehouse, and are they doing the correct amount per day and whatever. We're not like that. But the whole thing needs to run fairly smoothly, because it's a low margin business. Because in order to compete with, you know, like Amazon are the default option, but in reality, they're the cheapest for the top 50, maybe top 100 books. Once you go beyond that, they're far more expensive. But because they're the default.
Now, is that your PR or is that true? Because I don't know how I'm ever going to measure that.
Well, if
Jeff gives me a buzz now and starts complaining, you'll stand over that, would you?
Yeah, well, there was a report done now. I will say it's out of date. I mean, it's several years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, where they looked at Waterstones, Blackwell's, Kenny's, and I can't remember the fourth, and Amazon. And that's what they found. I mean, Amazon were effectively untouchable for the top 50 or 100, quite often selling for less than I could buy it for. But once you go beyond that, the way Amazon work, it's not really Amazon shipping it. It's a third-party business seller, and Amazon are taking 25% of, you know, their... So
which is very interesting. If you say that they're selling it cheaper than you can buy it, and yet there's somebody who's paying that extra 25% as well. Like, somewhere, you know, the maths does not add up.
Well, I think for Amazon... And I mean, I'm not privy to their inner workings, but I would expect, you know, it's effectively like, you know, a loss leader is what they do with a lot of things. Get people in the door. It's like putting the milk at the back of the supermarket. You know, everybody, you have to walk past a lot of stuff to get to it. And I think that's, you know, such is the theory for them. But yeah, they're the default option. That's the challenge for us, is to remove, you know, to shift enough people away from just automatically going Amazon are there and they're cheap, because they're sometimes cheap and sometimes not cheap.
I'm looking into both of your eyes. Do you both hate Amazon?
Hate?
I can't say I've ever bought anything from it. But it's just like, say, during COVID, during the lockdown periods and that, there was a lot of talk about Amazon, and the Irish consumer came out and said, I need to start shopping Irish and shopping local, because I'm worried these businesses might be in trouble. You know, my local shop could close. And it's obviously not just bookshops. It's all types of retailers, small and medium retailers. And a lot of it was, I don't want to shop with Amazon. I want to try and shop local, shop Irish. And it's just, that's who everybody, I guess, is in competition with. And it does make such a difference to shop with your local business and shop with your Irish business. It makes a huge difference to, you know, the town, the business, the inner workings to the country. You know, if you can't shop with your shop next door, go to the one in the city, go to the one, you know, somewhere else in Ireland, because there's always an alternative to Amazon.
And how many people are you employing? How many people are being kept alive because of people shopping locally, therefore the books with Kenny's?
So at the minute, I think we have 21 staff.
That's good,
yep.
Isn't it?
Yep. But it's not just the staff, it's the suppliers, it's the publishers, it's the couriers, it's the postal service, it's everybody along the chain who feeds into you getting your book in the post from Kenny's. That's where the money goes. It spreads itself out.
And yet I presume post-COVID, hopefully, is that there is this concern that we will move away from that we'll say, Ash, listen, as you say, Amazon is cheaper for some things, let's buy it there. Convenience, do we go back to that option again? Or how will you keep your nose ahead?
Well, yes. I mean, people have already started to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can see, and obviously, I now see Amazon vans driving around everywhere, whereas we used to not that long ago. So they're a constant reminder.
Oh, well, that's only changed now in terms of logistics, because they could have been delivered by DPD.
They were on post for delivering them, yeah, previously. No, absolutely. But it's a constant reminder, I guess, nonetheless. Anecdotally, it started to happen. I suppose it's very difficult to always, you know, to put your finger on this. How we worry about them is by not worrying about them. You know, we can't control what Jeff Bezos does. And, you know, as Sarah says, we have 21 staff. He slightly outnumbers us on that margin. So we can only do what we can do. And that's to make sure, like, we answer phones, for example. Nobody can ring up Amazon. Nobody can email Amazon and ask them for a recommendation.
I'd say I'll get a phone call from Jeff Bezos after this.
but there are ways we can be better, and we can do better, and we can constantly improve, and we can increase the speed of our deliveries. So we're constantly striving to do that and to improve what we're doing and to try and reduce our prices, or at the moment, keep our prices steady as our costs rise with inflation and whatever. We're trying our best to just make sure we do the best we can do and let the consumers.
It's very interesting that you say about that, about worrying about the opposition. I had a great boss who's unfortunately passed now, and his view was, forget about the others. Mm-hmm. You just do your thing.
Yeah.
You will not control the others whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, Sarah, we're going to run out of time, because we always run out of time. And you are the marketing manager, I think. I know you all hate titles down at Kenny's. You're a very democratic organization. Give me three top ideas that you guys have that have worked for you in terms of promoting the business, be it online or be it any other which way. Just a takeaway for listeners who may be small, who may be medium, or who may be large enterprises.
Well, I would say, you know, it now really goes without saying for small businesses to, you know, to be online. And, you know, not every business in Ireland actually is online. And it's so important now to, you know, start to make a website, to put your inventory up, and, you know, in whatever capacity it might be. And a lot of businesses did that during COVID because they had no choice. And I think that really showed that, you know, you really need to, in this day and age, have an online presence. If people hear about you, they're going to search to look for your website. You know, if you have to start small, you know, fine, but just have some kind of presence on there. Where people can find you. I think,
just as a matter of interest, when you are putting all of your books up onto your website, did you say you have a couple of 100,000 titles, or is it books? How many titles would you have?
It's 245,000 titles.
You don't have those all on the website.
No, that's what we have in the bookshop. We have 780,000 on the site at the moment. Now, that changes on a day-to-day basis.
On the site, you have how many titles?
780,000 as
How do you keep a track of that?
With great difficulty.
That's the population of a large island.
A good stock management system.
Yeah, it's you've got to be very careful, clever. I mean, because you've got to bear in mind, I mean, most books are published in the UK. most books we would sell in Ireland. So that's sterling. So you're buying in sterling, you're pricing in euro, you're selling. We sell on several different currencies on the site. So you've got to be cognizant of moving currencies, which particularly in the last 12 months, as you'll know, it's been, you know, not easy. The dollar in particular is in the last couple of months even is just... and
heading towards parity.
Yeah, be absolutely. Aware. And it's so you've got to be aware of that as well as just the stock management. The stock management is also currency management to a large degree. And so sometimes we have a sister who worked with us for years, and she used to get very scared when we'd come in the morning and there'd be loads of sales. You know, I'd go fantastic, and she'd go, something's gone wrong, you know. And but that's the key, you know, a good stock management system and enough people in the building who know what's what at all times, because it can be very difficult. And as Sarah says, we have a bookshop. So people, you know, customers don't often walk in, pick a book off the shelf and go, I'll put it back in the exact same spot, you know. So you need it can be a bit problematic, but it's, you know, part of the fun.
Oh, I'd say it is. Mm. So Sarah, back to you about, give me another top tip. You've said, it's odd about what you say about the website, because we have on the podcast 100,000, maybe a million times said, get up the website. Because half of it is paid for by your local enterprise office as well.
Yeah, I think you can get grants in the local enterprise office for
up to
companies.
2,500,
is it companies who employ 10 or under
10
people?
Yeah.
So absolutely. As I say, it nearly goes without saying, but not every business is online. So it's definitely the place to start.
Now, I know particularly that you want to get the help of Team GBS in trying to make a contact or connection into American universities, because that's a nice niche. I have to be very careful with my false teeth saying nice niche for you. What would you like anybody who is listening to the podcast, for example, we're very, very well connected into Connecticut and into the UConn, University of Connecticut. What could they do for you?
Well, we work with a large number of institutions and university libraries in the United States in particular, a lot overseas, but in the United States in particular. So we're the sole suppliers of Irish published books to multiple universities, including the Library of Congress, who we've been selling books to for now over 40 years. Yeah.
That's pretty prestigious, isn't it?
So it's, I think one of the things that is a bit different about Kenny's is that, yes, we have the bookshop and a huge online business, but we also deal in special collections and archives, and we buy and sell special collections. And it used to be mostly focused on Irish material. So like Irish interest is our area of speciality, literary and historical. But now there's a lot more international collections coming our way. And
now, when you say they're coming your way, like it's the world. So there's a world market, and therefore there are others around the world chasing the same as you. Yeah. What are you doing differently if you're managing to get those collections?
Selling them. So
Well,
ultimately, yeah, because I mean, some of these collections are worth an awful lot of money, and we're on a margin, you know, so we don't own them, and we only get any money if we sell them. A lot of places, agents would take them on but charge them a fee, you know, and then another fee if and when the item sells or the collection sells.
So you put yourselves in the line, do you?
Yeah.
We don't take anything unless it sells.
Well, it is, but...
So I come along with, you mentioned a collection there of 25,000 books. I'll put a number on it. Say it's £1 million. You, Kenny's, have to fund the £1 million and then...
Oh, no. So we if you have a... Let's say you have Seamus Heaney's archive, for example.
Yeah.
You've come into, you know, and you say, right, I need to find a home in a university or a institution or a library. We would catalogue it at our expense. We would create a catalogue, which is effectively a book, photograph it, all the rest of it. We would price it, and then we would go travelling the relevant places, whether it's the States, the UK, wider afield, Ireland, and identify where we think it would go, where we'd have the money, where it would like it, you know, and we would try and sell it. And it's one of these things, you know, like the literary world is centered historically around London, and then obviously New York as well in the more recent past. But so people kind of almost defaulted there, you know, and we've had a number of very large collections where people who are very well connected and very good over there have not been able to sell them. And that's nothing against them. They, you know, they're very, very good at lots of things, and maybe just this particular collection wasn't any, and they gave it to us and we managed to find a home for it. So we had a collection, for example, about 7 or 8 years ago, which was an anti-Semitic collection, which was an awful, horrible thing to be selling, but it was historically incredibly important. And it was effectively 500 years of European anti-Semitism is what it covered. Our uncle Connor found a home for it in a museum in New York, thankfully, and it was wonderful. But that led then to, I suppose, that particular man in London who had the collection, told his friends and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, we now have another, you know, couple of Jewish collections, not anti-Semitic, but Jewish historical collections, which are things we'd never, have come across. That sort of thing, the ripples in the water, because we sell one, people go, well, they managed to do that, so maybe they'd be able to sell this and so on. So
we'd look at anything now, really.
I'd say you probably would, because you're in business, of course. Yeah. You sell, and I haven't been into the bookshop in quite, since it moved actually, but do you sell anything else there besides books?
So there's an art gallery. So our grandparents, Maureen and Des Kenny, opened the bookshop in 1940, and they started by selling secondhand books, but they always had an interest in Irish arts, Irish crafts. So they started to bring in little bits and bobs that they sold in the shop. And in the 50s, then they started to properly start exhibiting, you know, works of Irish artists. And then in 1964, they opened up an art gallery in the living room of their house in Salt Hill, in the front room. So they had the bookshop in town, which was it was much smaller at that time. And they opened up the art gallery in the front room of their house in 1964. It was the first commercial art gallery in the West of Ireland. And our father, Tom, has run that now for many, many years.
That's,
and
it's really still progressive.
Yeah, so it's we have the art gallery space in Galway. We have about 8 to 10, or it could be, 10 anyway, exhibitions a year. So works of, like, new works by artists, mostly Irish. We've some international as well, but they'd all be based in Ireland. We have all of that is online as well. You know, we've our whole database of our inventory, I guess, of everything we have in the gallery is online too.
You know, as usual, I could probably spend another 2 or 3 hours talking to you about this, because then I kind of get an idea of what the business is like and then where all the little margins are and all the rest. I have to ask you two final questions. One is, because I asked you this before, but I don't remember the answer, what can Team GBS, the listeners, do for you to help your business? Who wants to take that one?
Well,
obviously they want to go and shop on your website.
Yeah, well, it's just to
introductions.
You know, I guess if you're interested in buying books, you know, we would be all about supporting, you know, independent bookshops and your local bookshops. So, you know, if you can't make it to your bookshop and you need to go online, it's always worth, you know, looking for your Irish independent. That's what we try and do, is to be competitive, provide the choice, good prices. You know, we have free delivery in Ireland on the website. So, you know, prices start from less than €5 on the website to get a book through the door. So it's, I guess, just, you know, if you are going book shopping and you're thinking of just going to Amazon, you know, there are alternatives our way, and
I think he's rich enough already. We'll agree on that one.
And we've personal customer service, so you can call, email, drop into the bookshop in Galway.
And you can have a chat.
Which is the great thing about the bookshops, is the booksellers behind the counter.
I'm hoping that both of you, or one of you at least, has read the email where I asked, who would you hire in a heartbeat? Who wants to answer that one?
We were talking about it on the train on the way up this morning. Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously we're avid listeners of the podcast. The best thing for a bookseller is, or the number one thing is, a passion for books and a knowledge for books. And then also somebody who people will like and bring in. So Stephen King, I think, would be an amazing addition to
Stephen King, the author.
Yes, precisely. Because not only would he know everything that you'd need to know if somebody came in, he'd also bring an awful lot of business with him.
I think you might be right.
And it'd be very easy to get him for signings, which would be wonderful as well. So somebody like him, I think, would be lovely, yeah.
Do signings bring in business?
So signed books, yeah.
No, but signings, you know, you so, advertise. Yeah. If Stephen King came to your shop, would you expect hundreds or thousands?
For Stephen King, I would expect thousands.
Well, it's rock star stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Some of them. Yeah, absolutely. And people who were involved in, let's say, sci-fi, fantasy, anything of that nature, the fans are very, very dedicated. I mean, there was a signing at O'Mahony's, another great indie bookshop in Limerick, of Derek Landy's last week, and they started at 3 o'clock, finished at 10:30. They closed the shop.
Wow.
And
well done, O'Mahony.
Yeah.
I get their email every couple of weeks, I think. Yeah,
absolutely. So, I mean, it's somebody like Stephen King would be wonderful in that regard. And then not everyone would bring in that level of, you know, of adulation, I guess, but which is fine and fair enough. Everyone has their level. But yeah, I'd like him. If he's free.
And I do know there's one other thing. There's always another thing, isn't there? You are one of the few companies that I've chatted to that doesn't have a problem finding staff.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Everybody else says, we can't find staff.
Well,
are books sexy or?
Well, bookshops, you often will, people that I speak to a lot would say, God, you work in a bookshop. That's one of my dream jobs.
There you go.
There's something about bookshops, and I think record stores is another one where people just think, wow, it'd be so great to work in a bookshop.
Don't think there are too many of those left.
No. Yeah, they're popular, I think, because they're friendly places. I think people sometimes have maybe an overly romantic view of, you know, pipe slippers, fires, and, you know, sitting down reading Jane Austen as customers come
in. Remind me again how many titles you have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're disabused of that notion if they have it pretty quickly. But it's a friendly environment. That's the key thing for us. And I think, in fairness, we're not alone in this in a bookshop sense, is to have an environment where staff like to come in, you know, because it's not just getting staff, but it's retaining the staff that you have. You know, one of the great keys to doing well.
And the kind of thing you're doing is you're literally selling the works and promoting the works of, you know, writers, authors, artists, like some of the most creative people in the country every day. I mean, it's such a good, great environment to be around, you know.
Nice idea, right? Yeah.
Listen,
we've run out of time, way over time actually, but Sarah, Tomás Kenny of Kenny's Bookshop in Galway, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to That Great Business Show. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com. Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Rate and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
If you haven't yet listened to Kevin Maughan of Urban Vault on episode 87, telling you how to save up to 80% on your business energy bills, well, do so right after this item. But first, do listen to our next guest, who has another simple, dimple way of cutting the cost, this time of currency conversion. You know, every time you go to buy sterling or dollars or whatever, the feeling of resentment you get when you see how much banks are taking just to press that conversion button. Many of you will be familiar with Irish company Currency Fair that handles SME level transactions, but since last year they have amalgamated with an Australian company and branded as Zai, spelt Z-A-I, to deliver currency savings to larger enterprises. And they say those savings can be up to 8 times what the banks charge. So, more than a chunk of change and, well, worth hearing about. Paul Byrne, CEO of Currency Fair, and Zai, welcome to That Business Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
8 times, is that real?
It is real, yes. We know that banks charge up to 3%. PayPal charges up to 5% to make it for, like, in terms of a margin, they add on to the currency against the interbank rate. We charge somewhere between 0.2% and 0.5%.
How do you do that?
Well, we're a technology-driven company, so we don't have the overhead structures that large banks have or pillar banks have. We basically operate as a self-service model. You decide how much you want to transfer. You transfer the money in. We give you an account, and then you self-serve. So our overhead costs are quite low. And because we're technology-driven, we access the wholesale market. So we generally price off wholesale rates. And that allows us to pass on all those savings to individual customers and businesses.
I saw Currency Fair. I remember it starting some years ago. I won't say how many years ago. And it was a tiny, tiny little operation. Probably touch and go for a while, was it?
Yeah, it was a small company for a long time. And to be fair, the founders who set it up had a great vision for what the business should be. And they were one of the first in the market to do so with a UK company called Wise. It used to be called TransferWise. And between the two of them, they really set about changing the FX market. And they did successfully change the rationale and the way people bought and sold currencies. We've taken that on now much, much further to be more high net worth individuals and our businesses. So we've taken Brett's original idea as the founder and commercialized it into a model. So we currently have about 270 employees, and we're live in and have licenses in 8 different geographic regions.
So, and growing, because I think you want to get to 450 people by...
By the end of the year, yeah. So
by the end of this year?
Yeah, correct, yeah.
I was looking at your website, I think it said 2025 or something.
No, it depends on how fast you're growing. Like ultimately, given inflationary pressures at the moment in terms of salaries, we probably won't get to 450 by the end of the year, because we have to be realistic in terms of how we hire people and how fast we hire them. And we did hire a lot of people in the last 6 months or so, about 120 in the last 6 months. So we're probably trying to bed them down now first and make them efficient and effective before we make the next bunch of significant hires.
Well, let me just stop you there and ask. You hire 120 people. You're a small organization to begin with, plus 120 on top of that. How do you bed people in? What do you do? That's not easy.
No, it's not easy. And I guess it goes back to my original, I suppose, DNA as a person. Like, I've been a very mission-driven CEO. Like, this is my fourth company. Like, I've had 3 very successful exits in the past.
Are you kind of a company doctor, though?
No, I'm a founder. Like, I don't come in and fix problems. I come in and start businesses and grow and scale them.
You make the problems.
Some people may say I make the problems for us to fix. But yeah, my ethos is to start with a very clear problem, customer-driven, and figure out what works for a customer. And if you can't solve for a customer problem, you don't have a business. And then...
And articulate for me, sorry to cut across you, what is the problem? I mean, for me, and I had some experience with this back in the years, I was going to use a bold word there, but banks, just the only thing that they weren't doing, maybe they've learned some lessons now, but they were almost wearing masks and taking your money.
Yeah, well, I guess like the way we do it, is total transparency. So when you come online, before you even sign up with us as a customer, you can see the rate we offer and you can compare that rate to everybody else online. So we believe in total transparency, and the name Currency Fair, the fair is critical to the name because it's about fairness and transparency. We may not always be the cheapest price. Like, you might get a better deal from somebody else online, but we always be the fairest and we'll always be the cheapest over the long term. And we always reward our loyal customers better than new customers. Most people do it the other way around, right? You know, trying to incentivize you to come on. We don't do that. We do the reverse. We believe in customer loyalty, and fairness is critical for us. So we build this ethos as a company around what we believe in and what problem we're trying to solve. So for an individual like yourself sending money abroad, we offer you an account. It's a payment account. We're a regulated business. And you can then use that account to transfer money and then transfer money out to any beneficiary anywhere in the world, basically. So it's pretty efficient, probably faster than banks can do it, because we do real-time processing, whereas in the Irish banking system, it's overnight.
Oh, no. I can tell you it's even longer, because from direct experience, how many fingers am I holding up?
5.
For 5 days to transfer to my little daughter over in New York sometimes.
Okay, well, I can tell you, if you do that with us in the morning time in Ireland, she would have had the money in her bank account before she finishes her breakfast.
That's what I didn't want to
hear. New York time.
And spent before lunchtime. And
spent by lunchtime as well. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the way we work is basically on transparency of rates and on speed and control. It's your money. It's your account. You can control how you use it. You're totally in charge of it yourself. And now we took that concept and then moved it to businesses. So for us, the bigger problem to solve is businesses, because if you think it takes you 5 days to send a small amount of money, imagine being in business paying hundreds of suppliers overseas all the time and trying to do it to banks. So we took the idea and moved it to, let's have a lot more currencies for businesses and let's embed their workflow and the way our software works inside their operation. So if you're a business, you can sit at your laptop or your PC and you can pretty much pay anybody anywhere directly through it, like call an API or technology interface with our software. So again, same concept, you're totally in control, total transparency on the rates, total speed, and you can also then effectively generate an email to the recipient to say, hey, guess what, your money's on the way. So people know in advance that they're being paid. So that gives the recipient a lot more comfort as well, not just the sender comfort that it's happening in real time. And that's what we're trying to do. Like, we're trying to build a global real-time payments network. And foreign exchange is an important part of that, because everybody's focusing on foreign exchange because of the rate, right? And the margins that banks make. But for businesses, the speed and certainty is as important as the rate, because businesses generally get a better rate anyway. So they generally don't pay the same rate you pay when you walk in over the counter. But they don't get a great service because, you know, they have to basically book a rate, then send the money in and blah, blah, blah. They don't know when the money arrives. Whereas you can see online in our system when the money arrives at the recipient. You can acknowledge, you can basically send an email to the recipient, automatically generated to say the money's on the way. So you know you've problem solved, payments made, and you know it's going to arrive pretty quickly. So if the person doesn't get the money, you're going to hear about the next day, not 5 days later, 6 days later going, where's my work? You know, the old story, checks in the post. Well, you can't say that.
There's a lot of businesses who still like to say that.
Yeah, but you can't say that with our system, because anybody, a recipient knows if the money's been sent, they would have received it already. So in that sense, it's transparent at every end.
And is the big end the bit that you're calling Zai, Z-A-I?
Yeah, Zai is the overarching brand for the business, right? It's a Japanese word, means trust. So there is a real meaning to it in the context of what we're trying to do. But yes, we have positioned the business payments platform as Zai, and we kept the Currency Fair brand, because the Currency Fair brand is actually quite well known. Like, we will be obviously one of the larger providers in Ireland, but Ireland's a very small market. We will be probably the second or third largest provider in Australia, which wouldn't be well known here, but obviously in Australia, it's a much bigger country, it's a much bigger market. And we'd be quite strong in the UK. Now, the UK is very competitive, there's lots of players, but it's a huge market, because every currency is different to sterling. People don't, you know, so whereas in Europe, you've got the euro in most countries. And in and out of the States is a bit different, because most businesses would accept US dollars internationally. So like the FX component isn't as big, other than for remittances.
And you didn't have a background in currency.
And I was a customer of Currency Fair. That's how I got involved. When I sold my last company, which I was pretty much based in Texas at the time, and I actually retired back to Dublin. And I was a customer, and I was happy.
I love people who retire.
I know. I retired for 6 months, actually. And then I knew one of the investors. And then the investor asked me to come in and mentor the founder, Brett, at the time, because Brett was going through some growth challenges and he was trying to kind of pivot the business a bit. So after about 6 weeks of working with Brett, he asked me to take over from him, which was like, usually CEOs don't step aside voluntarily, but it was his idea. And he's still a good friend of mine. And I sometimes say to him, I wish I hadn't said yes, jokingly, obviously. But yeah, so that's how I got involved. It was at the request of the original CEO, Brett himself, and one of the investors, Frontline.
So your previous businesses were?
The first one was Trintech, which I took public. I was the CFO at the time, and that was a great time for Irish tech, because three or four Irish companies went public in the US and NASDAQ. Doesn't really happen anymore. And I was the CFO of Trintech at the time. And then the business effectively got sold to Verifone, and the business is still around. Actually, it's now trading as Verifone. So it's a great success story for Irish business, but not in Irish context. In fact, you'll still see Trintech technology in Germany and in the US 20 years after we sold the company, right? So then after that, I started working in the treasury business. That's how I got involved in money and money movement and money management and point of sale reconciliation. And then the treasury business sold out in 2010. And then when we were doing the treasury business, one of our customers was a healthcare company, and they were trying to use the treasury product to do healthcare invoicing. So they kept complaining about the software didn't work. So we flew up to Cleveland, the Cleveland Clinic, and we spent a day with them workshopping the problem. And then we realized, well, no, there's a product here we can develop. So we started a new company in Chicago.
I love your brain.
In Chicago, based on this problem solve. And then they signed up as the first customer, obviously.
And is that your brain? You're looking all problem the solving. Time, finding a problem.
Find a solution to a problem that's kind of in front of me. And then get people energized around the problem solving, like start with the why, and then build an idea and build a business plan, build a culture, hire the right people in, and then let go of the business to management, which is, you know, so I can keep strategically moving the ball forward. Yeah, so the healthcare business then, it grew from 0 to 10 million in 2 years. So like it was, it grew like a rocket ship. And it was fantastic. The weather in Chicago wasn't great in the wintertime, obviously.
Oh, I believe it.
It was brutal.
Wicked.
It's brutal.
Wicked, yeah.
But, and then we sold that business to 2010. And then we were sitting around one day in Dallas, thinking what we'll do next. So myself and two of the founders of the healthcare business started another company called Concuity. Called Cadency. Concuity was the healthcare company. And we started Cadency in 2011. And we sold that at the end of 2015. And that was when I was a currency of our customer. So we.
That's when you retired.
Yeah, and the business was hugely successful. It grew to 60 million revenue in 4 years. Wow. In the States. And we sold it to a PE firm. And it's the business is still still doing really, really well and still very, very strong, which is a great, which I obviously do, I love looking back at the businesses and knowing that we built a solid, strong company rather than just a real quick win. Like we built something meaningful.
But do you ever look back and say, geez, I could have spent another 2 years now and doubled that again or tripled that again?
I do. In fact, one of my co-founders just left the company because he stayed on with the PE firm and he's just left and he's now going to work with me in another company that I'm involved in basically as an investor.
Now, remember, you've retired.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I forgot to return. And so he... Yeah, so we just talked about that about 2 weeks ago. We were just saying, like, did we sell too early to the PE firm? And probably in hindsight, yes.
Ah, yeah, but you know enough that that's called jobbing backwards.
Yeah.
You never know. Sure, it could have gone pop as well.
The market could have been in difficulty. We could have been in an interest rate environment, inflationary environment. Yeah. Anything could have happened. So, like, you have to deal with what's in front of you. So yeah. I never regret anything. Because I always think, and I have a saying that I say all the time I use with the employees in the company, is when you're sitting in the car driving, there's a reason the front windscreen's a lot bigger than the rear view mirror, right? So, and
who teaches you all of this stuff?
I make it up as I go along. No, I study, I read a lot of books, actually. I genuinely read a lot of management business books, yeah. And
I've never read them. That's probably why you're successful and I'm not. I just find them to be kind of ego boosts for
90% of them is, but what I do is I skim them. I never read them in detail and I pick out a few nuggets and then I tie the nuggets together. So what I did was, starting in about 2009, we realized that we were making the same mistakes again that we made in the treasury business. So we thought, hang on a second, like part of being a bit experienced is you make less mistakes as you go, and you're always going to make mistakes, but make less of them. So we started writing things down. So I built a playbook. So I actually have a playbook called how to build a company and scale it globally, which we built, myself and two other guys, we built it over maybe 8 or 9 years. So we basically built structures and processes and diagrams and about explaining things to people and how we're going to energize people and those kind of things. So now we're at the point where we still make lots of mistakes, but hopefully make less of them than we made before. So yes, so as we go along, we learn and we do look back. And as I built the playbook, I picked ideas from my own experience. I picked ideas from other people's experiences. I talked to other CEOs. I never believed in having too many mentors, because most mentors are people who write books, to your point. And, you know, they want to tell you their way, but their way worked for them in their company. Their way doesn't work for me and my company or you and your company. Every company needs a different DNA, has a different DNA based on the personality of the employees. And you should never hire employees who are the same. You should always hire people with different opinions and different perspectives, different geographic backgrounds. So you get the whole melting pot of ideas and create a fusion. That's one of the things that we really focus in on.
Now, I've only met you 15 minutes ago. I've never met you before in my life, and I'm just still trying to figure out, are you very difficult to work with, or are you a fascinating person to work with? Or maybe both.
Both.
Yeah?
I genuinely think both.
Do you kick ass?
I wouldn't be known for having a lot of patience. And I think if you ask anybody who works with me, they probably say from time to time they felt the brunt of that.
And what do you get really cheesed off with? What kind of things tick you off in terms of what sets off your impatience?
People not being honest. I don't care about bad news. I genuinely, if there's a bad news, just tell me the bad news and we sit down and we strategize how to solve the problem or whatever the issue of the day is. What I do not like is people who don't tell me the truth or who tell me they'll do something tomorrow and then it's tomorrow 2 weeks when I get it. Like, if you can't get it tomorrow, tell me tomorrow. Because what happens is, if I think it's tomorrow, I'll set up some other task or something else contingent on that actually happening. So now everything the dominoes don't fall the right order and now we're struggling on certain things. So, yeah, so I do. So in the current business, we emerged during COVID. So we actually, it was quite difficult to get the deal done because you never met the people. So we met the people in Australia for the first time in February 2022.
Having merged in?
Having started a conversation in March 2020.
Yeah. Right, mad,
and having closed the deal during 2021.
All done by Zoom or by whatever?
All done by, online, effectively by Zoom. And so we met them in London for the first time, and I had 10 people in the room. One of them hadn't even started yet, but she took a week's holidays from her current job to come in for the week to meet everybody else. And I started the week off not how they thought it was going to start. They thought I was going to start it off by like strategy, you know, get into it. And I started off by, I brought in a mentor or a facilitator. And we started the whole week, well, tell me about yourself. Tell me about you. Why are you here? And like they're going, hang on a second. You heard me. You know why I'm here. No. Why are you here? So, you know, to get into the psychology with people to say, if you're going to bond as a team, bond as a team, because teams are more important than individuals.
Okay. You told me that you learned all of this stuff out of books or your memoir, whatever.
Yeah, experience in books, yeah.
But go back further. What's the background that got you to there? This is fascinating.
No, I grew up on a farm. Like
where?
I'm from Wicklow. So I'm from a place called Glen Ely, County Wicklow.
Oh, I know Glen Ely very well.
Well, my sister is a TV chef, Catherine Fulvio. So I grew up in Glen Ely.
Away.
Yeah.
Small town.
It is small. And my brother and my sister are also entrepreneurs. So all four of us were entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
My mother had a B&B.
Yeah.
She was one of the first in Ireland to do farmhouse B&Bs in the late 1960s. And she started Walking Holidays in Wicklow, which ultimately was the first Walking Holidays in Ireland. That was back in the 1970s. So my mother was always an innovator. My father was an innovator. Like we were trying different things at farming all the time.
But farmers are, by their nature, entrepreneurs. They have to be.
You have to be, yeah. Exactly. So that's where I started. That's where I got all my, I suppose, early education and the ability, a willingness to take some risk. Because the biggest issue with being an entrepreneur is you take calculated risks, which, in your own mind are calculated. Some people might say they're a bit reckless sometimes, but you're taking risk knowing the consequences and knowing what you can control and can't control.
Yeah.
Whereas most people will never be an entrepreneur because they just can't get out of that comfort zone of having to have certainty on everything they do. So I let my entrepreneurial flair early on, and my parents had ups and downs. Like, you know, we acquired land and then interest rates went up to 18-19%. So we suddenly had problems with interest, you know, with prepayments and all kinds of things had to change. And so my parents adapted really, really well. Like we actually bought more land to get scale. And then we went to the tillage and all. And, you know, it was great for me. I loved working on the farm. I still actually have a farm myself. And I am, but that's where I learned. And then I went to college, and my parents always said to all four of us, me and my three siblings, you have to get an education. You have to have something to fall back on. So if you're going to start a business or do whatever you want to do, always have something to fall back on. So if it doesn't really work out and you change your mind, you're not stuck in your 30s with nothing. So I did a BCom, and then I did accountancy.
Just about the same time I was in UCD. You look about 20 years younger than me. What the hell?
Oh, see, I delegate. A lot.
Compared to me, you mentioned something there about energizing people.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
How do,
do you frighten the bejesus out of them?
No, that doesn't work.
Okay.
It only works once. I can tell you, I have lots of examples of how that only works once. No, what I actually do is, look, when we start something or do something, I start with, why are we doing this? Like, why are we here? Why are we in the room? What are we trying to accomplish? What's the problem we're trying to solve for us or for the customer? And then work it from there outwards. So it's not about me or you. It's about the problem in the middle of the room, which is, you know, generally we're launching a product or we're launching in a new country. And then we build from there and we work collaboratively. And if you work collaboratively with people, basically it's easier to energize them because you're not directing them. They're contributing. And the more people can contribute to a problem solving or strategy, the more they take ownership of it. And the more ownership they take of it, the more invested they become in what you're trying to build. And it becomes a snowball. And you just got to trust the process and let them make mistakes. And if people make mistakes and you handle them, handle it the right way, then they get more invested. If you handle it the wrong way, then they get turned off and they won't take any more risk or take on any more responsibility. So there are some points at which you just have to let things go a little bit and just trust that things will come around, even if you have to have a few losses along the way.
Do you have a very high turnover of staff?
No, opposite. Oh, really? Very low. During COVID, we probably lost maybe 3 or 4% of the staff.
Oh, sorry, four.
We only had about basically 100 between the two companies.
So it was 3 or 4.
Yeah, right. It was tiny. Now when we did it, after we did the merger, we did have some turnover in Australia because the culture we wanted to bring of like this entrepreneurial scaling culture, excuse me, they didn't quite buy into to my way of doing it, mostly because they were very entrepreneurial. The original founder, like, is a bit of a genius in Australia of the Australian company, except that he was very entrepreneurial, like way too entrepreneurial. So he had like customers doing different things with the same software and they weren't aligned. So you couldn't really scale anything because everything was bespoke.
Okay,
but he was, yeah. But he was a, and like, I actually have met the guy a couple of times actually since in person. And he's a great guy, but he's not a scaler. He's a startup guy. And we were trying to move.
That's interesting. Is that, you know, you've identified another type of timescale person. Yeah.
Oh yeah, there are, yeah. And then you basically, so we had to make a few changes there, and that was disappointing in some respect because some people we really thought would want to stay and see it through to the, you know, to the 100, 200 million revenue line. They decided, you know what, I'd rather go back and work in a small company where there's only 10 of us in a room. And there are people like that.
Because it's more fun.
Yeah, there's more fun when it's when everybody's involved in every decision. But like once you get to 20 people, that falls apart very quickly. So there are different stages of DNA you need at different stages. Like I'm a founder to scaler to kind of, I would say, maybe a 200 million revenue. And after that, when it gets very structured and very processed and very corporate, I'm probably not the right guy. But that's, you know, that's just...
So when are you going to sell Zai?
We're not selling Zai, actually.
You just told me that if you get to the right scale...
Oh, no, somebody else will come in and take it over. Like, yeah. I will just step aside and someone else will take it to the next level.
As in manager rather than a new owner?
Yeah, professional CEO, yeah. Probably, yeah. And because, like, it has huge potential. We have a broad mix of investors. Now, ultimately, someone might come along and make an offer for it, and then you kind of, when someone makes you an offer, you can't refuse. You generally don't refuse. So we will probably, 4 or 5 years from now, we will probably look at an IPO of some kind for the business because we are aiming to be quite big globally.
How big? Excite me.
We want to, well, we have an internal objective of basically being worth north of 10 billion in value, basically.
Was that the B word?
Yeah.
10 billion.
Yeah, in value, yeah. Like we've looked, Stripe is a benchmark success story for Irish payment companies.
Yeah.
Now, they did it out of the US. Now, two Irish guys, they're still an Irish influenced company, but they got a lot of funding in the US, which helped them scale in the US first, which is the world's largest payment market. We're plowing a tougher furrow. We're trying to do it out of Ireland, where there's no home market, and Australia, where there's a smaller market than the US. But
if you go over to San Francisco, wherever, and put out the bowl, you'll get your money, won't you?
You would have gotten up until maybe a year ago. Yeah, pretty quickly, yeah, okay, pretty easy. Now, yeah. Things have changed a bit, but yeah, we will. We probably will raise money in the US. And we're launching actually in the US at the moment. I'll be there next week. Now we're actually doing a formal launch on Wednesday or Thursday of next week.
And that's for the Zai side of the business?
Zai. We've already signed up a couple of customers. So we're now officially launching it. We're now going live. Well, actually both Currency Fair and Zai. Currency Fair, we went live in the US within April. And a month later now, May, we're going live with Zai. Realistically, our biggest growth opportunity for us is probably in Asia. Mostly because every country has a different currency. So in terms of cross-border trade and the complexity of cross-border trade, there's much more complexity in Asia. And honestly, the Asian economies, they will recover pretty quickly and they'll grow very robustly, whether it's Indonesia and Vietnam, where we've done a bit of work in China. We're actually trying to grow our China book of business at the moment. And we're looking at Malaysia. We're already in Singapore and Hong Kong anyway. So look, we do see a lot more opportunity. And also in the Middle East, basically in the GCC area, like with whether it's the KSA or the UAE. So there's a huge amount of opportunity that's not necessarily in the US for people like us to grow and scale pretty effectively.
And do you have to hawk yourself around to all of these countries?
I do, yeah. I do travel a fair bit. And obviously during COVID...
Bit? Because I had Tony Smurfit on a long time ago, and I think he told me he spent 250 or 260 days a year in the sky. And I said to myself, that's a lot. I said other things as well.
That's a lot. I agree. That's a lot. And not that much. But I mean, when I was building the other businesses, before Zoom and Google Meets and everything else that came along with electronic meetings, yeah, I was in the air an awful lot. I was probably spent more than half my time away from home, like probably two thirds of the time like Tony Smurfit, traveling all the time. It's a lot easier now because you have electronic basically meeting and it's quite easy to do Zoom calls and everything else. Yeah. So I've been... Probably I would hope maybe a quarter of the time maybe to be traveling. But like I find traveling interesting because no matter how good an electronic call is, until you meet someone face to face and have a conversation with them about what you're trying to solve together. It's more difficult.
It's a different interaction. That's why we always ask people to come in and join us on the podcast in person. We haven't done any, I think I've done one Zoom over 88 podcast, during COVID, because it's just a different vibe, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's totally different meeting people in person.
Yeah.
Like, it's much more relaxed and you can have better, deeper conversations with people. And you can also give the people bad news and vice versa. They can give you bad news.
And I'm also reading you and I'm still laughing to myself. This guy's a ball of energy. This is mad.
Yeah, I am. Well, I suppose I am. I am energized about everything I do. I mean, that's what gets me.
Fantastic.
Gets me going in the morning. Like, it's the other thing I do a lot of is I do actually. You know, I said later earlier on about mentoring. You know, was a bit of, can be challenging because it's people's ego that ends up being mentored. However, I haven't said that, I actually do mentoring myself, and I do support a lot of female entrepreneurs. And a lot of small businesses, and I am I've invested in two small businesses as well. So I try to pay it forward, basically, as well. So I get energized about a lot of things, not just Zoe, basically, as well. So, yeah, I do think it also there's an obligation on people to pay it forward. I genuinely do think that we don't do a good job in Ireland at the people who make money helping everybody else, because now things might be different now, but
I think it is changing because we're learning. And because of people like you coming onto a podcast and saying, you know what, you've got to do this.
Yeah.
And certainly other people that
have
met.
And a lot of the problem was before, people who made money were going into property and other things where it was, you know, they thought it was easy to make money, right? So they weren't
then they lost all their money again.
Yeah. And so they weren't actually staying involved in technology per se. Yeah. So consequently, you know, I do help with that. I actually set up as well a equivalent of a Dragon's Den type scenario with Frontline Ventures for small startups as well. So
that's fantastic. Two questions. One is, just give me one. Do not do this type of tip to startups. Something that just you say, oh, for Jay's sake, if I see that stupid mistake again.
I would say, yeah, do not try and raise money without a clear understanding of the problem you're trying to solve. Too many people come in to raise money with an idea, but they haven't researched what the real solution of the problem is or what alternatives are already there that somebody else has solved the problem in a different way.
And if you, again, we go down this little rabbit hole, like, I find that people say, I'm solving this problem on, say, I don't know, better headphones. How do you find out? I know the internet is there, but somebody out there is already working on better headphones or better cups of tea or better whatever.
And we're not the only ones do what we do, exactly. Right? That's your question. So what makes us different or better? I think what makes us different or better is we look at a broader problem than just have a problem making a payment. We say, well, hang on, we can solve that problem, but we want to give you something else. We want to give you a platform that you can do anything you want to do with any payment type. You can get paid by a wallet, you can pay by a card, you get paid by a bank transfer, and you can pay out to a card, to a wallet or bank transfer. And we will provide you with service. So we give you a proper service around it so you can always have someone to call. So one of the big pluses of Currency Fair is there's a phone number. So literally somebody can talk to a human if they don't like what they see online, or if there's a problem with their account. And people actually greatly appreciate the human contact, even though it's a self-service. I know it sounds a bit of an oxymoron, but if self-service system with human support,
it's funny,
is a massive plus.
I was just talking to the Kennys of Kenny's Bookshop, and they said one of their big pluses is you can pick up the phone.
Yeah.
I think someday we're going to go back to the phone. Final question. I could spend another 10 hours talking to you. The hire in a heartbeat. Who would you hire in a heartbeat? I sent you an email, and if I didn't see you, you just looked at me and said, what is he talking about? I'm looking for the person that you absolutely would love to have on your team, if you could, if he or she would join you. Could be anybody. Could be Cassius Clay, or it could be Julius Caesar. Could be anybody.
I would have said Muhammad Ali, actually.
Would you?
Yeah, I would have said anyway, mostly because he's...
that was a good choice by me, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you why. Because he is an icon.
Yeah.
To a huge number of people, and he was someone who was able to fight against prejudice and was able to stand up and say, you know what, enough is enough. I want to build something. I want to build something, basically, in his case, it was a career in boxing. But as he went on in boxing, he stood for something.
Yeah.
You know, his national service, like, you know,
the draft
and all that kind of. He said no. So to me, someone like him who culturally would fit with what I believe in, which is, okay, here's a problem. Here's what we're trying to solve. We're trying to solve it in the right cultural way with the right cultural context for the company and also be multicultural. Like, we have more than half our management team is female. We don't promote that, by the way, because we don't see it as an issue to promote, because we're equal, right?
Yeah.
people who have one female person promoted because they've got one. We don't promote anything because we say, hang on, everybody's equal. And that's why I think he is a good icon.
That is a lovely idea. And it's also something that we're very proud of, is that we have gender balance on this program, but we stopped saying it because
you have it.
We're equal.
Yeah, and exactly.
We don't need to do it because we do it. We just do.
Yeah.
Paul, that was really, really interesting. That's Paul Byrne, CEO of both Zai and Currency Fair. I'm sorry, what's the other company that you've just started?
I'm a director of Bright Flag. I'm the chairman of the board of Bright Flag, which I invested in. It's a legal software company run by two great guys in Dublin. And I'm also a director of a company in the US called Visual Lease, which is a lease accounting software business.
So you're not really busy. And you're retired.
I know, retired, yeah.
Paul Byrne, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural de facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to de facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to de facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
That Great Business Show.
So, what do I love about business? Well, everything, really. The creativity, the energy, the climb, any wallness of it all. And of course, I love a good pivot. We keep in regular contact with our guests who join Team GBS to see how their businesses are progressing, as they are part of the family, after all. Back on episode 17, that's a long time ago, we had Kevin Ward of Bray based Reward Catering with us, talking about his beautifully designed catering vans. They really stand out because they're all chrome and look like something out of the 1950s in the USA. That business has gone on to become one of the largest of its kind in Europe. And now they're back, and I say they because Thomas, or Kevin, has brought his brothers with him because they have launched another business, ServBlock. ServBlock aims to reduce the cost of drugs to the patient using blockchain. And that's what I think I'll need the three amigos in front of me to explain what it actually does. So CEO John, COO Kevin, and CTO Thomas, all of the wards, welcome to That Great Business Show. Who wants to talk to me about what ServBlock does and getting involved in blockchain? Nobody really understands blockchain, but one of you must.
Well, thank you for the lovely introduction, first of all, Conal. It's great to be here. I guess I'll start at the very beginning of ServBlock and where it happened. Like, I've personally spent 10 years working in the biotech industry, many of the world's leading pharmaceutical companies. And they all share a common problem, especially around digitization of paperwork. Usually you think of a cutting edge new technology when we look at these kind of businesses, but surprisingly relying on outdated and even paper-based systems.
Mad, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
You're ticking boxes. I was actually doing something just the other day and I saw them filling out and doing date stamps and stuff.
Yeah, so I was sitting in Sweden and just the start of the pandemic. I was doing this paperwork-based exercise remotely out, and I got a phone call from the pharmaceutical client we were consulting for, and they asked us to get back to Ireland immediately. The country's gone into lockdown. So I thought there has to be an easier way of doing this. First of all, digitizing it, but perhaps doing it remotely. And that's where the blockchain aspect comes in. It allows us to, you know, have verified, trusted data captured at source. That's immutable and can't be changed. A lot of people think of blockchain as cryptocurrencies, but to us, blockchain is about to revolutionize many industries, and in particular, regulated manufacturing.
Now, just go into that little detail, because I do agree with you, blockchain is the future for lots of things, but just explain to it. Say you met me in a coffee shop, I was going to say a pub, but of course we'd never go in there. And you say, blockchain works how?
I think if you can pull it back to what we've done in the pharma industry for 40 years, is this thing called data integrity, and we look at these Alcoa principles. If blockchain had been around 40 years ago, I think many of the rules and regulations we have in the industry probably would not be there. We look at it as a joint audit trail. So a lot of equipment has audit trails. You can see exactly what actors and what has been done or hasn't been done. You know, this is a very rudimentary use case, but essentially we can have trust and we can stand over the data that's generated by any actor within the supply chain. So I guess on a very basic level, it just allows us to have confidence in the data that's being generated.
Because every piece of data is captured and kind of locked in.
So what happens is we use these things called ledgers or distributed ledger technology, where every actor in the supply chain or every actor has a node responsible. So when one of these ledgers are updated, the rest of the ledgers in the consortium have to agree that what is in this other ledger is valid and also that the nothing before it has been tampered with. So therefore, it's tamper-proof. It's also quite secure. We're talking about cryptographically secure transmission of data. And it's
that's what I was thought. You might, I worried about you might start talking about cryptographically secure data transmission.
Yes.
How do you sleep at night?
very.
But you are solving a real problem. And basically, if I understand it correctly, it's about that data going around the place, if it's on paper, can get scrunched up, can get coffee stains, the wrong tick can go out to the wrong place, a wrong analysis could be made. But if you use this new technology, newish technology, blockchain, a lot, not all, a lot of that is taken out of it, correct?
That would be a very fair assumption, fair description of you.
Imagine if you said no. I'd be sitting here. Let's retake that all again. Now, the three of you, all three entrepreneurs, including the vans. Let's talk about the vans because I don't really want to go to the vans. I want to talk about Serveblock. The vans live, but the vans not just live, but they're doing exceptionally well.
Yeah, so we're extremely busy.
Was COVID good to you?
Yes, it was actually in the end. I suppose when it first struck, we were like everybody else, very nervous. Supply chains were impacted. But once we got over the minor issues at the start, you know, we've doubled our orders in the last kind of 12 months or so. So we've just back from San Francisco last week where we delivered one of a bunch of units for the Four Seasons group.
The hotel
in,
group?
Yeah, in the Silicon Valley, Four Seasons in Silicon Valley.
That is mad. Now, these were being made down in...
Rottnew.
And did you then move that back up to Dublin?
Well, we still hold both premises. The majority is done in Ballymount.
And just to explain again to those people who don't understand, these are the gorgeous caravan type. I mean, excuse me when I explain this, with the lovely shiny chrome that were originated in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And you're now selling them back from Ballymount or Rathnew in Kennewicklow to San Francisco.
Yes.
Get away.
It's crazy, yeah. We're actually just looking at the moment and making plans to open up an office or a distribution in the States itself. And then also another one in maybe Germany or Poland. So we're exploring that at the moment, but we have the orders there for the next couple of years, which is really exciting. Yeah.
That's fantastic. But you're also, I can't remember, what are you? Are you a COO, are you?
I suppose it's a nice title to put on my job. I've got the complicated part of explaining how Serveblock works and selling it to customers. As you can
I'm
see,
asking John, the wrong guy. I'm John, asking the CEO.
John just told you, in his words, the most basic version, which probably sounds like a different language to most people.
Well, I certainly didn't understand a word, but anyway.
But it is. It's quite a technical product that needs to be, I suppose, broken down and explained. I suppose one thing that John always says is, you know, it's... if you're getting a new Mercedes Benz, or you know, you don't really worry about all the components underneath the engine and how all of the individual parts work. You just know it goes from 0 to 100 and it does it in X amount. So that's basically what Serveblock is. It's revolutionising, you know, what we've been doing for as long as we can think, but just moving it forward. And all the customer needs to understand is that there's integrity behind it. It's secure. And, you know, it eliminates the risk
and
error.
Who or where is the development team? Am I talking to the development team?
A mixture.
Thomas is our CTO. He has a background in the tech industry, but we...
That'd be Thomas Ward.
Thomas Ward, yeah. Another Ward.
So I myself, I come from a background in IT, working for the likes of Microsoft and Oracle, from an SRE perspective.
Hang on now. What is an SRE perspective? I'm going to leave the room soon.
Service reliability engineering. So it's got
making
to do
sure
with,
that it's keeping
Everything's up and, you know, working redundancy and scalability and geo-redundancy. So how to bring a service, you know, availability zones up around the world and how to keep them up.
And are you still with Microsoft?
I'm not, no. I departed with them a while ago.
This is interesting. So actually, you're putting your flag down now, aren't you? Is that this is going to go places?
We hope so. Like I'm at this pretty much full time now. Thomas is at it full time. Kevin's 50%, really putting the effort in there, you know.
Kevin, you know, you've got to up your game.
One day.
So where is it at in terms of, are you three the company at the moment? And follow-up question, if I'm allowed, is I always wonder, is there somebody else doing something exactly the same or very, very similar somewhere else? Silicon Valley, Malaysia, I don't know where.
So we are the three founding team. We've just hired in our first in-house engineer, a blockchain guy, as a terrific engineer, master's in blockchain. We outsourced some of the builds through a company based in Belarus. So obviously that had a bit of an impact. We are currently about to go live with our first customers. So we've been on this journey a long time now. So we've ticked a lot of the boxes.
What's a long time for you now?
So we've been that, well, look, I've been researching this since 2020, March 2020, full time in it since, I suppose.
Only 2 years ago, you know. It sounds like 20 years.
It's a lot for a tech unicorn.
it's a long time, you know, without money coming in the door, I would say, you know. Yeah. So we've been at it now and we're really ready to hit the ground running. We've got a lot of interest and I guess what we're doing is quite revolutionary. As Kevin said, blockchain is just an enabler to what we're doing. We're solving a real world problem. The blockchain aspect is not actually something we really advertise. We're just about trying to solve that problem for our customers. And regards people doing it, there's a couple of indirect competitors, you could say, but nobody is actually, I suppose, solving the problem. They're using like document repositories or having, you know, ways of managing the documents. We're actually solving a real world problem using a really cutting edge technology.
And how big can it go? What is it? MVP? Minimum. Oh, no, that's the minimum viable product. What's your addressable market? It's not
your TAM, your SAM, and your SOM. So the hygienic, the traceability element of pharmaceuticals is worth about 8.75 billion annually. Of that,
I love the way you just say 8.75 billion. That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. That's the overall market. Yeah. Realistically, you know, what we're targeting is the hygienic component subsection of that. It's about 875 million annually. We reduce that material traceability effort by approximately 90% by automating the process. So we're looking at, having an attainable market of about 87.5 million annually.
Which means when you're going to value that, they put a very big value on that recurring revenue, don't they?
They do. It would be very nice, all right.
Normally, what would they put? What multiple?
Thomas, you can answer this one.
Oh, you're like well over 20 to 30, I'd imagine.
So 20 times 87 would bring you to the magic number.
Mm. Yeah.
Yep. The billion.
It would. That is the goal when you start off in these projects. Like, we have a successful business there. Kevin is a sales genius, so there's no reason why we can't do it, you know?
A good point is that's just with the product which is just being built out, the MVP. That's
minimum
just for that.
Minimum viable product.
The minimal viable product.
I warned you.
So that's...
You'll go outside the door.
That's just for that specific area that we've built the software out for, which is the components.
Within the pharma industry. Has it got further applicability?
It can be pretty much applied to any industry. So we've actually...
Come on, somebody else must be doing something. No.
There is a lot of companies out there for using blockchain for traceability elements.
Yeah.
We're really focused at regulated manufacturing. So we're talking about right from the manufacturing source through the supply chain. Everyone, you know, there's people out there who are looking at traceability from when the product leaves the manufacturer's door to when it gets to the customer. We're going one step previous to that and looking at the manufacturing process and even going further back looking at raw materials. So actually, one of our, you know, we've done a lot of customer discovery, talked to a lot of people about this. One of the big things we had, we met some senior people in the industry and they both came to us with an alternative use case, but it was actually the same use case. And that's how contract manufacturing organizations share data between the sponsor company, which are the main pharmaceutical companies. So it's an avenue we're looking at and doing research in at the moment. We've obviously, you know, this is all very new technology, so we're busy filing patents on all that kind of stuff.
Getting stuff going, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
That's expensive.
Yeah, it is.
And where are you going to get your patents? Across Europe or across the world? Or
hopefully across the world, you know. So we've
but
just
that's very expensive, isn't it?
It is. But when I think when we have the opportunity to, you know, grow a product from the ground up that has a very real life benefit, you know, we're talking about reducing the inefficiencies of pharmaceutical manufacturing or even medical device manufacturing and reducing that cost. I think not only is it a worthwhile project, but it's also could be quite lucrative.
I'd say it could be.
I think it's also good to say then as well, it is very expensive and it's also a lot to understand and how to actually start the process of filing a patent. But, you know, speaking to the local enterprise offices and speaking to Enterprise Ireland, or, you know, getting support from people like that, they point you in the right direction. They might put you in touch with the people with the experience. So that's all a bit, good bit of advice. You know,
FX Kelly is one of the big ones, isn't it? Are you for the patents? And yeah.
Yeah.
Believe so, yeah. We worked with a guy down in Cork. We actually, as Kevin mentioned, we got quite a bit of support from the NDRC, which is the National Development Research Council. We did a lot of programs on Founders Weekend, and the one we actually applied for happened to be in Cork, but it was remote. So although a lot of our network we've built from that is based in Cork, we feel like we almost have a connection with Cork at this stage.
Can they understand you down there? That is fantastic. But I know something else. Am I right in saying, have you got a business running already with a large multinational called Microsoft, or is that my imagination?
Yes, very exciting stuff that we're working on. So we have access to the, we're working with the early access engineering team of Microsoft based in Seattle. And we're currently co-developing a product with them. We can't say too much about it.
Tell us.
There's a lot of, non-disclosure and stuff being signed, but we're getting great support from those guys. And we are.
And what would that mean to the business? I'm not asking you to tell me exactly what it does, but does this accelerate you to the, like 100 miles an hour or 1,000 miles an hour?
It's probably more than 1,000 miles an hour. If you think about it, Microsoft has, 70 million partners, 80 million customers worldwide. Like, they'll essentially help us build a product and put it in front of their customers. We couldn't ask for a better partnership.
And do they want a cut of that, or is it just adds to their suite?
I'm sure it just adds to their suite, and, you know, we get to use their underlying technology and stuff. So I think it's a win-win for everyone.
Okay, I like a bit of that. And then funding. How are you going to fund all of this? Are you going to pay for your patents for a start?
We're hoping to ask you for some money.
The guy you actually wanted has just left the studio before you. So maybe I'll put you in touch with Paul Byrne at Zai, because he may have some access to that. Now, how are you going to fund, or who is going to fund you?
So we've just recently part of the CVVC network in Switzerland, in a place called Crypto Valley, it's called Zug. So we're part of their acceleration program. They've started to an investment as part of that program. We will look, obviously, as we expand and grow, and, you know, these customers are coming and inquiries are coming in quite regularly, and we will need to initiate a seed round of investment, you know, towards the latter half of the year, maybe even sooner, depending on how some of these things go.
You have to get paid, remember. And you're looking a bit slim.
That's the first time anyone said that to me.
Seriously, come amount of money that you need to raise.
You know, we'll all have a sit down, and Kevin's usually the numbers guy. He's great with the old calculator, but we're probably looking in the region of maybe 1 or 2 million, you know, to really hit the ground running as we need to scale this opportunity.
I can't remember, is it Deloitte or is it PwC? Who claims to be the blockchain experts in town at the moment?
Oh, there's a lot of them. So I think Accenture at the dock is one, and PwC definitely have a lot of leaflets out there about it. But
yeah, will they not help you and put you, you know, connect you with the right money?
I'm sure they would. We're actually part of the blockchain network in Ireland, and they have Blockchain Ireland Week coming up very soon, and they do a lot of events. And because, you know, it's not just, you know, the Facebooks and the Googles in here, all the blockchain companies are moving into Grand Canal Dock, you know, so there is quite a vibrant ecosystem for blockchain companies within Ireland.
Another kind of big thing as well is it's not just about the money that you raise. You know, we actually have had a lot of people looking to invest. But it's, I suppose, the people with the right connections and what support they offer with that money.
What we call smart money.
Smart money, exactly, yeah. Conal, yeah.
So who would be, paint me the picture of your perfect investor?
Well, for myself, I could imagine, especially for the MVP, if you had an investor
viable
who was...
product. I told you, outside the door.
If... you know, maybe there was an ex-VP of a big pharma company, or a VP of a pharma company, you know, who had obviously...
Well, we have the most of them here, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why we started with the with this MVP, is because there's a lot of indigenous, you know, small manufacturing companies here leading into the big pharmaceutical companies. So we believe that starting the product off there will open doors then into the larger contract manufacturers.
So you said to me, round figures, that your world at the moment is, what did you say, 87 billion in total, the market. If you broaden it out in terms of all of the other regulated areas that you might go into, like, is there an end to it?
There's not enough zeros on the calculator.
Really? Is it that
like,
much?
You think about it, like, and I think, you know, it's we're putting quite a broad range on things, but anything where regulations are required, anything where people's safety or people's trust or there's any, you know, could be misrepresentations or fraud along the supply chain, all of these areas are bound to, you know, benefit from blockchain implementations.
Okay. So if people want to find you, you'll be at Serveblock. Now, I have one final question. I don't know whether you're going to give me three answers or one answer. The hire in a heartbeat. I hope that you saw that in the email.
We did. We did. We had a discussion. We had a discussion, quite a lively discussion about this in the car on the way over.
Good.
Yeah.
Lastminute.com.
You only sent it this morning. It's not our fault.
God, nobody reads the email. Who would the Ward brothers, John, Kevin and Thomas, hire in a heartbeat?
Well, we thought about this and we'd have to say, you know, probably Michael O'Leary. You know, he's cut the inefficiencies and the red tape in the you know, aviation world. He's reduced the cost of flying for the normal person in the aviation world. We could emanate 10% of that in pharmaceuticals. We'd be off to a good start.
Certainly would.
Absolutely.
And he seems like a nice guy.
I have been on the phone to him. He is actually. I know he's got this face and he likes, you know, he likes his persona, but he's actually quite funny. So, Michael O'Leary, you are hired. Lads, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. You will come back because obviously this is the second time.
But thanks for having us back on.
You also have a different business next time as well. Probably a bottling plant or digging for gold or something like that. Thanks so much for that. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 88. Now that was busy. Do please share this podcast with all of your connections on social media. And do it now, please, before you forget. A click of a button for you, commercial success for us. I like that phrase. Also, don't forget to press the subscribe button now, and then you will never miss us and we'll never miss you. And you can always talk to us directly via our LinkedIn page. Great brands like Big Red Cloud, Microfinance Ireland, ISME, Virgin Media, Mudros, all advertise with us. Your business should do likewise. We work with our great friends here at the Dublin South Podcast Studio, including a ringmaster of sound, Mark McCarthy. Later, studio manager Peter Rice adds those zips and zings that make our podcast the best-sounding business podcast ever. Dublin South Podcast Studio are open for business, and if you want to record a podcast, have a chat with Peter. If you want the media group to produce your podcast, then I'm your Buchel. Talk to me, please. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. And do not forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So from me, Conal Moran, for Míle Buíochas agus Slán Tamall.